We're talking about finite element analysis, monolithic domes, which is the generation of beautiful pictures, like this one. And specifically, I thought I would talk about my latest fun project, which involved this fake chapel, and I have been looking at some domes that they put string gauges in. So, I say they, my brother went down, and some of the other cells, like South Industries, they went down there and they installed strain gauges in various locations in actually all of the domes in Birmingham, Alabama for the Faith Chapel project. But I specifically am going to just look at one dome, which was dome number 3, where we got some really good data. But before we look at what happened in dome number 3, we'll talk about the first thing you need to do when you're doing analysis is to build a computer model. So when I build a dome, I go into the computer, of course, and you have to have a modeler, and this is one actually Chris asked me to do, but it looks kind of cool, because it had two radius and pure curvature, but it had to be scanned.
Is it possible to demo?
So, when we want to look at the dome in the computer, we can actually model it very accurately, or we can make some assumptions. I try to model it as accurately as I can in the geometry, and then you mesh the model, what they call meshing. You chop it up into little pieces. This one is actually chopped up into big pieces. I start out with these great big squares just to verify that I've got the whole thing working properly. And what the computer does internally is it takes each corner of this little piece and it calculates the stresses and the strains, and sometimes you can ask it, if I load this, is it going to fail right here? You can look at the buckling cones and decide if your dome is going to fall in or not. It's especially helpful for what Chris was talking about earlier. He was talking about the cutouts, because we have really good equations that have been tested for just a regular dome with no cutouts, or just one with a cutout at the very top. But we don't have really closed form solutions, meaning like exact calculations. We have to make a lot of assumptions. Exact calculations for around a window, around a door, if you want to do something more exotic, or if you want to take something, say an ellipse, and many of you might be able to, an elliptical house. Now, in a smaller dome, it's just as accurate to call Chris and have him use his engineering judgment. But sometimes it would warrant, you know, a finite element analysis. But if you have an ellipse and you don't cut it quite at the center, there is no closed form solution for that. Also, if you build one like that, you saw a picture of Larry Burns' house where there were three hooked together and there's saddles in there. There really aren't closed form solutions for those. But you can use engineering judgment and guess those accurately. But if you're in a critical situation, or you cut something out at the top and you're going to hang a whole bunch of things off, then you really do want to be sure if your dome's going to fail. But what I'm doing at dome number 3 is verifying. We want to know if the theory, which comes from people like David Billington, and this is what Dr. Wilson taught a class on shell theory, and so this is what I learned the shell theory equations from, was David Billington's book, and I know that Chris uses it. Chris helped me with my thesis. But Dr. Wilson also has a book, and this is if you're wanting to build a house. I wouldn't buy this book unless you really want to get into the mathematics. If you're an engineer, this is wonderful. I'll buy this book because this one will take you through dome calculations and actually has a program that you can put in all the criteria that'll give you stresses that goes right along with David Billington's book. But I wanted to see if my computer simulation matched up with the shell theory, and also if that was actually happening in the adult with the strain gauges. So we can measure the strain, and we can turn it into a stress, and then look at it, you know, divide. It's a little bit complicated, but you, you know, can divide out some of the cross-sectional area, the rebar we put it on, to get the horse right here. And we can compare it with the computer simulation. And I have a pretty high confidence in this computer program because it is the one that I used with my thesis, and I did extensive verification on the basic models. And they use it in the aerospace industry also. This is another meshed model, and this is probably more accurate. And what you do is you run the model a whole bunch of times until you refine it, make the elements smaller and smaller and smaller until your answers aren't changing very much. And then you can say, okay, I'm finally getting a good answer, and I'm gonna go with that. So you have to refine the mesh. And then you apply the material properties. You can write in the strength of your concrete, and you can say how thick your concrete is. You can say what the modulus of elasticity is, and some other things, Poisson's ratio. You have to apply boundary constraints, and that all that means is, am I going to take the dome and am I going to assume that it's completely fixed into the ground? Well, that's not a very good assumption usually. Whereas you're just looking at the top of the dome, you can do that. Or am I going to say that it's simply supported? And then you apply your loads. So you get it all meshed, and you apply your loads. So you can, you have to put on gravity, of course, because that adds to the dome. And you have to put on anywhere, say like if you're hanging a basketball standard off the top of the dome, you need to apply that. Or if you're gonna have snow, you have to take that into account, whatever. But for this analysis, where was we had control of the days we took the strain, and we didn't have anything extra on the dome, we just went with gravity loads and compared those. And in our stress analysis, we got, it ranged from negative 6.5 to 35.5 kip per foot. Here's dome 3, and this is the actual measured data that we got out of dome 3. And this is in, oh, it wasn't 30, it was 3.5. I made a mistake on that slide. This says it was 3.89 kips per foot, the largest force on this. Hang on. All right, I'm just going to look at the junction, channel 1 and channel 2 is here. In channel 1, and channel 2, you can see that they took this many readings and we got these readings out of it. But you can tell that we range from about 65 kips per foot to about 41 kips per foot. Okay, so if we look here at what Billington predicts is going to happen right at the bottom of the dome, that's that 38. That number 38, which is actually 38,000 pounds per foot. And then we look here, this is the hoop force, and what we're getting from the computer analysis is almost 36,000 pounds per foot. And I pulled up the wrong thing, but I remember the number of the hoop force. The hoop force that we actually measured there was 42,000 pounds per foot. So it's very close. I was kind of surprised. What you haven't seen measured is the predicted big giant buildup in the ring. So we're interested in placing more strain gauges right directly in the ring because you can never draw a complete conclusion by, you know, one or two or even three. In fact, statistically, you probably have to have about 30, and then we can maybe draw something. But this this matched up really well. Anyway. And here's the moment. Build is also...
The moment, I say, is the bending in the shell as it approaches the edge there.
Right. And do you know what he means by bending? Okay. So, the moment in the shell. So, this I believe, was almost exactly with the experimental results of 4.5 kit feet per foot. I was very surprised to see that. I shouldn't have been. But over here in the predictive, it didn't predict quite as much bending as was actually there. But it was still, you know, not too far out of the ballpark. But again, like, we'll have to wait and see another one. So we compared to the experimental results and compared to shell theory. But there are the better applications for this is for more complex problems. And again, this is one that Chris and I were looking at. Had a rectangular opening, which there aren't really any equations to use for that. And he has really good engineering judgment, so he said, he just threw out, oh, it's just built this thickened area, and we'll try to make it 12 inches thick, whatever. And we ran a buckling analysis, which is a really fun thing to do with finite elements. So we ran this buckling analysis. And we found good forces, which were, you can tell that it was distributed a little bit unevenly because we had some loads. So there were loads here and here and here and here, and then one here and one here. So this side had more force than this side did. So you can see that the forces around the opening are not evenly distributed as you would maybe think. Would be if you were just looking at gravity load.
And would that be like an opening in the top of the dome?
That's right at the very top. It was instead of a circular skylight, a rectangular striped skylight. And to make it more fun, they put it slightly off center. So, all I did was run this analysis to back up what he thought was probably right. And yes, indeed, he was right. And with the amount of, there's a meridional force, those are the ones, the hoop forces, this way. But the buckling analysis, it says EV 19.87, all this means, this number just means, with all the loads that we put on this dome, you can actually tell with this kind of a computer program that whatever you put on that dome, you have to multiply it by 19.87 to get the kind of loads that would actually cause failure. So we used to scale them down and then scale them back up, but this new program has a way to just put them in there. So all the loads we put it in, we actually had 19.87, but you have to go a little tiny bit lower than that just for factors.
We typically use a factor safety of 3 or 3.53 and 7 depending on the application.
Yeah, I think generally we use 5, but and then you have to reduce some of this by about 80% because they assume within the program a lot of buckling analysis. So if you get sent a buckling analysis, you may ask them, did you assume everything was linear? Meaning, when we break it up into those little squares, we're assuming that those forces are just going to go nicely in some little straight line across, which we know can't happen, especially as soon as you add a curvature of a dome, you're not going to have linear behavior. The material's all going to be non-linear. So I ran this using a linear eigenvalue analysis, but you have to put down a knockdown factor, and that's usually 80%. So you have to take 80%, and that would be what our buckling loads would be. So I just thought that was kind of a cool picture too. This is one that Chris and I did on the top of one of the Birmingham domes, and we tried several failure modes, several designs. First, we tried a thickened ring, just and it had the little circular failure area, and then we tried a few ribs, and this is actually a skylight in the top of the dome, and they were going to put this giant skylight at the top, a tower kind of on the skylight. So Chris said, well, why don't we throw these ribs on? So we put, I think they were like a foot wide and a foot deep, all these ribs coming off of here. And then we put the distributed load from the giant tower that was going to go around the skylight and ran it through the buckling analysis, and it shows you exactly. And this, of course, these weren't even, so you can tell that some of these places didn't have as much load.
Yeah, I think we had the wind on this direction.
Oh yeah, we did.
So we have a big twisting right here. Yeah. So this is all has a twisting in this direction. Like
we had hurricane force winds on right
exactly.
Yes. So we had this giant tower and a hurricane hitting it.
When you say a giant tower, this isn't just a little cupola skylight. This is like a big tower.
Do you have a picture of that? It's
I actually, the first slide.
Yeah, go back
slide,
to that slide there.
Let's go back.
You can kind of see it. It's just enormous.
It's huge.
It's very, very large and hideous. But
there it is. It is a little hideous, but.
Yeah.
You can see that. You see how, and that dome, what's the diameter of that dome sitting on?
Well, the radius of curvature was like 2.
The tower is almost as tall as the dome is itself.
Right, and it's just a great big sail sitting up there to catch wind.
It's hard to see. Is that a computer model or
no? That's a picture.
I mean, but that's not the dome. I mean, that tower is actually there. I can't tell clearly.
Yeah, it's
right
on top.
The tower is. Yeah.
Is it a solid structure tower?
It's a space frame. It's a space frame, but it's got glass.
That's what it looks like, a mesh from back here. Yeah.
Yeah. It's aluminum with glass panels.
Yeah.
So it's solid.
Was there a reason for that?
It's a climbing, it's a rock climbing wall. I don't know, they wanted to climb up.
It's something the architect dreamed up.
I don't know. But you can see, I didn't put these in the slideshow. This is the last chapter of what we worked on my thesis project. But this was when there were no ribs in the buckling. And all of Chris's great engineering plans. And I think that we used a 200, no, it was 101.5 foot radius of curvature. So I don't know where they could have gone.
So it's a fairly good sized dome. Yeah, there's the ribs that we put
there. There are the ribs that we put in there.
In that picture right there? Or is that maybe it's the next one? What did the red spots in the middle of the that green, yellow, and red in the middle? Is that the point of failure? Is that the
no? That's the it goes from tension to compression. Okay. The more red it is, the compression that's in that shell element.
Okay. That's where the buckling's going to occur first.
That's stresses that you're right. Yeah.
I think it's appropriate they use red in the buckling analysis because we always associate that with the worst case. Right. So if you can't really see the scale, but you can see that these are lower numbers, and this is where these should go actually from 0 to 1. It kind of overshot the mark, but it's at 1.0. But this is definitely where the buckling happens.
You were talking on one of your first slides about the material that was used and how that affects the buckling or the strain. Is this with that? Was this dome built with that small diameter rebar that David likes, or does it change using a greater rebar in the material, meaning maybe a full half inch of steel or iron rebar or 3/4 inch versus the little 1/4 inch, whatever it is that
he's
doing?
With our buckling analysis, we don't, and all these domes that I modeled. We don't even include the rebar in the model. We're using it mainly to design for the reinforcing so that we can say this is, oh, don't worry about it, I am a spiller. Just don't hurt me.
And so what she's saying is that the model models the stiffness of the concrete, because the rebar doesn't add any stiffness per se to the concrete. You take the numbers that the model comes up and says, okay, here's what strain, here's what stress we have. And I say, okay, for that stress, I need to have a half inch diameter rebar at 12 inch on center. So we take this, and that's how we design the steel.
Okay. Okay. This is as if there is no rebar. It's just straight concrete. That's what you're looking at.
Exactly. Because we're just looking at how the shell interacts with itself, with the stiffness, and all of the stiffness is gained with the concrete.
Okay.
All right.
I'm sorry. You said part of the structure is the tension. What color represents the tension?
Well, this is actually a deformation picture.
Okay.
So it's going to show you where the failure is, and it's okay. Associated with the eigenvalues. You can kind of see that. And it's saying 0 to 1 for this is the eigenvalue. And when, in this particular buckling analysis, if you get a 1, that means failure will occur. If you get an little number here, 0.605 in the green, that means that you have, like, if you took 1 minus 0.605, so you got a 0.4, whatever, 0.3 something, that would be your chance of failure there. So, or actually your chance of that is 0.6, but of it buckling first. If you go here to the, let's go back up here, see the stress analysis. The tension, sometimes on these, you can't rely on the color. Because if you look at the hoop forces, and these don't come out very well for some reason on the screenshot program that I have, some of these are negative down here, but they quickly turn right here to positive. So some of these blues, the negative is compression, the positive is tension. So some of this blue is not compression. Over here, if you look, all of this is compression. And so it just depends. You have to really be careful when you get one of these not to assume that the red is always going to be positive or that the blue is always going to be negative. You have to read the legend on the side. The computer will just go from lowest to highest. If it's all negatives, it'll go lowest to highest negative, or it'll start with negative and go to positive, lowest to highest. But that Birmingham dome, that was kind of cool. I don't know what they ended up going with. No, they ended up putting it at the top of that?
I don't. We gave them those options.
Gave more recommendations and then said, have at it. If we looked at channel 1, that is the horizontal rebar at the dome wall junction of dome number 3 that we looked at. So this is the strain gauge information from right at that red room. I pulled it out. All right, it predicted 35.5 feet at that kip per foot, right at the dome wall junction. And what we were getting, this number right here is the first one that they took. And what we're seeing here with the strain gauge is they, as soon as they started spraying the concrete, they took a reading. Then about an hour later, they took another. And then a couple days later, they took another reading when it wasn't about thickness. So this last number is the number they took after they had all the concrete on the dome and after it sat there for a good amount of time, a couple weeks. Then they took that reading. So this is the reading we want to see. But I thought it was interesting that from the readings, we could see that right when you're spraying the dome with the concrete, we're getting the steel taking up more of the than, of course, the concrete will, because the concrete's wet and there's not much there. So we got a number of 41.02, which doesn't matter, it's 41, but we're 40. And over here, we do have 35.5, and I think that's pretty close, but also everything isn't completely set up at that point. We haven't achieved full strength in the concrete, so it would be nice to go back over there now after it's set for, I don't know, how long have they had going through the
6 months from what I've
been. Yeah, I think they should go back and take another reading and see if we get a little bit closer. As we saw that with the theory from Billington, we were very close to what we're getting here. And I would predict that that this number will come down just a tiny bit more. This is what I did to get all of the, when they do triggers. So I took all this information and just to get one of those little numbers, I had to decide what was the good number. So I used my math judgment, not my engineering judgment.
I think that it's worth pointing out too that the theoretical, it's nice to see that the actual values, you know, where they're at, because the theoretical values, sometimes we're still guessing a little bit because we don't know exactly how much concrete has been sprayed up there. If it's a little thicker over here, you know, if it's 4.5 inches it's supposed to be 4, or if it's 3.5 inches, and we've got these variations. And so we're still making almost as many,
I'm making so many
assumptions to do this as to do the normal way, but in the end, we're coming up with very similar results, and so that's...
Well, I'm assuming 4,000 PSI concrete, which I agree. And I have the concrete, I went through all the concrete reports. They had some guy come out on site and test all the concrete. And he did a cylinder test, which isn't even a good test for, well, you know, it's kind of a rough guess, but for the shotcrete, it's not as good because they don't spray it in there. And some of them were... we were getting like 3,600, 3,700 PSI. Some of them we were getting 7,200 PSI. Some of them were 5,000, but on average it was up more about, I'd say 4,500 to 5,000 PSI. And so, but I'm using 4,000 because we have some lower, some higher, and that's what I'm. And so that probably does account for why my FEA, because that's what I've assumed there, works well with the shell theory. This I've also assumed 4,000 PSI concrete to get my modulus of elasticity. So, and you have to use that to convert the strains into stresses. So I have assumed something here, which probably isn't entirely true.
On the canister test, were you saying then that it was getting a higher value
actually
of
it's
PSI or lower than the spray shotcrete?
I think it's lower than the actual shotcrete concrete. So even though it's higher than what I assume, I still think it's higher on the
dome.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because you don't get the consolidation. When they take those tests, they just scoop the mud out, put it in a cylinder, and they have to rod it X number of times, 13 times with a 5/8 rod. And then they put it in 3 lifts, and then they cure it. Whereas if you're shooting it, you're pressuring it into, forcing it in, and it seems like you always get better consolidation, okay, almost all the time. You've got, you know, as opposed to normal just concrete that's, you know, pours. When you use shotcrete, you always get a better product in the end, just because of that pressure that you've applied it with.
So what you're saying, if I'm understanding correctly, is these numbers, these triggers that we're taking into consideration, the numbers that you're adding for the material, these numbers are still a little conservative.
Yes.
They're fairly accurate on the conservative side, is what you're saying. Is that correct?
Yeah. And I would like to see them go back at the 6 month mark or year mark. I know some of these don't turn up for a while. I don't know if Josh is down there.
He's over in Milton. So the next step you're suggesting is that we take the triggers again. Mm-hmm. Could we test some of the concrete in place? Test the strength of it in place at those triggers?
That'd be better, so then we can know. But the thing is, it is still going to vary from, like Chris said, We could start trying to be nitpicky in some of this stuff. We're pretty close. We're never going to be right on, and the thickness comes into play also. And so even with a really good team, and I had such fun this year because I went to the workshop that these guys put on. It was awesome. And I got to look really cute, and I asked Gary out for the first time, all dressed up in my European suit. I was shooting this shotcrete on the wall. I got laughing so hard, they're all, James Goddard did that. It was so horrible. And I know that even the good guys, it can vary. You can stay 3 inches and maybe it'll be 4, maybe it'll be 2.5. You don't know for sure what it's going to be exactly. So, you know, unless we went around the wall, I think it would be instructive to take one sample. But we're still assuming at this point.
Well, for me, the best part of this is that we're getting correlations.
Close.
They're very close, and that's, you know, we use a factor of safety margin that's, you know, right where we want to be. I mean, exact number, but it's close enough for me, and I love to see that. I would be very disturbed if it were completely off from what I assume.
And there's a rebel school of thought out there right now that maybe we're all wrong. And so it has been really nice to verify and say, well, maybe we're not all wrong about this. I mean, we don't have to change everything. But I would like to see the buildup in the ring. So I want to put in the future, and maybe I'll just write y'all reports. You never have to come to listen to me talk. And tell you, like, after we find out, because we need them right. Just even this, I say it's right, the rain beam, it's at the rain beam. I can't say that, you know, I haven't seen where we put that rebar in that string cages. Is it right? Is it right on there, or that, you know, how? What is the zone? What is the tolerance for where you're going to see that occur? Do you know?
I would, you know, theoretically, it's down at under the base of the dome where you have the thickened ring beam area. But is it all concentrated in there, or does it migrate up to shell more? That's a good question.
So I think in the future we have now enough data, because I have a lot of data from going up and down the dome where we're seeing that it behaves as we predicted. But I would like to concentrate on just putting a lot of strain to the right in that ring. If we can find that big tension buildup that's predicted, in the ones that we have so far, I don't see the tension.
But that's occurring only in the skin wall construction model, right?
No, actually, there's a tension buildup predicted in all the domes at the bottom, because the dome's coming down and there's a lateral force that's pushing out right at the bottom of the dome.
In the stem wall, we just bring it up to the top of the stem wall, but when the dome already hits the ground, we just have it in the footing.
Okay.
Yeah, so in the footing, in the top of the stem wall. Sometimes we call the ring the top of the stem wall and a little bit of the dome, or sometimes people put it all in the dome. I don't know if I've seen it all in the wall. We do it all in the wall?
We have done all in the wall.
All in the wall. The ones that I've looked at, they've been splitting it up a little bit here and there. And then all the food.
Does some of that downforce on the, when you're bringing your dome clear down, and don't have a stem wall, you're creating more down vertical force. Doesn't that have a tendency to diminish the lateral?
Well, they split up. So the down force is sort of independent of the horizontal thrust. But
generally, what you're saying is correct, though, because if you go all the way to the ground, you'll have a dome that's more of a hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a perfect hemisphere, you have no outward thrust, theoretically, at the base.
Sure. And we've looked at tanks quite a bit lately. See how shallow this one is. This is really shallow. But if you're talking about going, you would want to put a little lid. But we've been looking at oil tanks that are three quarters of a sphere. I think he's got a big hefty section in here about the oil tanks. Here's that. So this kind of thing, where then you don't even have a tension buildup at the bottom of the dome, because it's all compression at the bottom.
So I've got a kind of a random question for both of you guys.
Awesome. Okay.
In fuller geodesics, right, the lower the frequency, the more angular it is, right? right? So you get, you know, you can get this very, very angular geodesic, and then as the frequency of the dome goes up, it gets rounder and rounder and rounder and rounder. And ultimately, if you did a hemisphere, say, and you'd have half of a great circle arc in which you'd have almost an infinite number of points of those great circles, okay? In this, in the monolithic model, when you use, when you run the rebar down from the top in some kind of a star pattern, or and then you use the rings coming around, are you essentially replicating that concept of an infinite number of great circle arcs, assuming you build a hemisphere?
Right, yeah.
Or does the rebar constitute a finite number, a limited number of great circle arc simulations?
Shell theory.
I realize this is kind of a vague question here.
Shell theory basically takes a, that to a finite, to an infinite number. So it's when it's an actual curve, shell theory goes through the math that it is a curved surface and not individual discrete. So
yeah,
we're looking at this as
being they're just looking at a monolithic case with hoop stresses and radial stresses and the holes.
Right. But I understand. I mean, you're, what you were saying is what your mathematical model is looking at, correct?
Yeah.
So I'm still okay. So I mean,
and our rebar is arranged for that.
In a real world physical event, you know, say we go out there and we build the dome, and there's going to be an X number of pieces of rebar basically coming from the top, you know, or meeting at the top, right? Right. Does Are those moments of force that are going down, are they traveling down the rebar, or are they traveling
down through the shell?
Just through the shell.
Yeah,
and the rebar is just simply holding the shell
together. Rebar is for temperature shrinkage, where it's in compression, it goes through the concrete.
Okay, okay.
And then the rebar is mostly for when you have tension, because the concrete doesn't take tension.
Right.
So then that's transferred through the concrete into the rebar, and back out through the concrete as you go down. So they work synergetically.
Okay. The model predicts this, and you go out and measure it and say, okay, how close did the model and the real world match each other?
Yeah,
and when we measure it in the real world, we take out, we put it on steel, and that's pretty easy to take out the properties of the steel, so you can just get the forces right there. So you can actually say, you know, it's not only the steel, it's probably not over. No, in fact, it's better over time. The harder the concrete, the longer the time is, the more time it passes, the stronger your concrete gets, and the less the stress is. Yeah. Think how long that's had to cure. So that's why I'm saying that even with, we saw that with, just in a small way with those experimental results that I showed you with the first trigger when they had, you know, the wet first layer of concrete was much higher than by the time they got all the concrete on the dry. But they let some of those layers dry, warmer, dry. We're going to see those numbers come down even farther the more and more time passes.
Kept warm and humid, it will cure definitely.
The only thing time-wise that you ever would have to worry about, you know, with the thicknesses we're talking about, you wouldn't have to. But if you get too thin, you know, concrete creeps. So you could think about creep, maybe it would be a long-term problem if you had something that was thinner. The top of the dome maybe buckling. If you had a load up there and you made it too thin and you wanted to stand for a really, really long time, you'd want to take that into account.
What happens when you put the chain link fence in and shoot that covering?
Well, they did that, you know, a lot of years ago, or I'm sure people do it now, but throw cement to them, kind of sounds like wire mesh, but, and
are
they have done wheelchair
covering with a dome? No, that's
texture.
Yeah, that's just
coating. Oh, are you talking about the coatings?
Yeah.
That's your job.
Well, I think he's asking about the additional weight, right?
Yeah.
Loading.
Oh,
loading.
I see. I thought you were talking about reinforcing steel. Yeah. Well, some people have done, you know, meshes and all that stuff.
So what does that do to the dome when we throw on an inch and a half to 2 inches of concrete on the outside?
Not much.
No, we just designed for it at the beginning. Just add that weight, you know, as we're initially designing, once we add that extra weight over the whole thing, and yeah. And you're
with a small dome, it's really not going to change much at all. There is one interesting thing when you go to the offices. The main headquarters is there's a green dome and a red dome, and then the dome with the big opening. And we can't put a change hill on that because it wasn't designed to begin with for the extra load with the large
opening. With the large opening.
Right. Yeah, so make sure you decide it first if you're going to have a big cutout. But if it's a small dome, the dome doesn't care. The dome really doesn't.
Does this
affect
if you burn also the
dome? What do you see?
That's just added weight on the edges. Yeah. I mean, yeah, we'll just...
Oh, you mean like... Yeah, just if you say you're going to do it right out of the gate, you can look at it and analysis, and just it's really not very difficult to add a little bit more pressure on the wall. And it won't take that much more reinforcing for a house. If you're talking about roofing a house, it won't take that much more. So I would like to thank Chris for helping me too. I was looking in here. You were too modest, but they didn't say that.
Yes.
And you're too modest to tell them to put it in there.